I'm one of the elders here. In fact, I'm the one who works here and gets paid for being an elder. The others have proper jobs, as it were. I say that because there's a few folks here, I think, here for the first time. So it's really good to welcome you all and explain perhaps who we are and why we're where we are at the front. We're reading together today from Genesis chapter 50. Continue this series, Turning Points in the Understanding of the Sovereignty of God. And today we look at Joseph. Now the text, if you like, is verses 19 to 21. But I'm going to read from verse 15. Jacob, Joseph's father, has died. They've gone with a whole tranche of people back to Canaan, where Jacob's being buried. They've returned to Egypt, and this is where we pick up the story. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Turning points in the understanding of the sovereignty of God. Me brethren and sisters, I is well excited. Because this series is well cool in it. I don't know why I wrote that, but just felt I needed to express in some way. It's really exciting, this series. Do you not think? Catch it. 2 weeks ago, those two older folk we looked at just after Christmas, Simeon and Anna. The climax of their lives lived in the knowledge of the sovereignty of God. And we saw their trust, their contentment, their joy that they experienced as they saw that baby being brought to the temple, the salvation of the world. Last week, as the series proper began, Abram, who trusted God with his life. And it meant leaving those creature comforts. It meant leaving the city and the bright lights and a roof over his head and actually becoming someone who travelled as God led him and pitching his tents here and there and everywhere. It meant leaving his parents and standing on his own two feet in the faith. This is what we looked at last week. It meant going into the unknown. It meant trusting God. It meant depending on him. And we saw, didn't we, and took on for ourselves how God promised to bless him that he might be a blessing to others. Today, I think, is even better. Another angle on this sovereignty of God in our lives as we look at Joseph together. Just looking through my sermon here, Lynn's done some of it and Jeff's done the rest of it, so I might as well go and sit down now, I think. His life, Joseph's life, was a bit of a roller coaster, wasn't it? He was the 11th son of 12, but the firstborn of Rachel, who was Jacob's favourite wife, and therefore Joseph was the favourite son. And therefore he was spoiled and given that coat. Actually, I looked for images to do a thing, but struggled for about half an hour to find anything decent apart from that one you had, which was the man who won the singing contest, wasn't it? And who was wearing that coat. Yeah, so I thought, oh, I won't bother. But you did. Anyway. So he had these dreams, and he was a tad tactless, it's fair to say, in sort of swanning up before his brother, saying, you're going to bow down to me, and all this kind of thing. To the point, in fact, where they hated him, plotted to kill him, put him down a well, but settled, in fact, for selling him to some travellers who took him to Egypt and sold him as a slave. The brothers took his coat and poured some blood on it from an animal and took it home to Jacob, who believed that his favourite son, Joseph, was dead. In Egypt, to begin with, things work well. He becomes the housemaster and is entrusted with everything. His master's wife tries to seduce him. Joseph refuses. She falsely accuses him, and he's imprisoned. You know, this is like an episode of Coronation Street, isn't it? Or EastEnders, probably more than Coronation Street. He has skills as a dream interpreter and interprets dreams to fellow prisoners, one of whom remembers him when Pharaoh has a dream of the 7 fat and thin cows and the 7 fat ears of corn. Joseph interprets are going to be 7 years of boom and 7 years of bust. So we need to save now. I sound like David Cameron now, don't I? 7 years of boom, 7 years of bust. Save, save now. And Joseph himself becomes prime minister of Egypt. And after a few years, the brothers return to Egypt, or come to Egypt looking for food. Joseph recognizes them. He teases them. But eventually, as I'm sure you know from your Sunday school days, they're reunited. Joseph's reunited with his father, Jacob, and everything is good. It is a roller coaster of a life. He has his lows down the well. You don't get much lower than that, do you? Being in prison, I guess, was a low. But he has his highs as well, and here he is now as Prime Minister of Egypt. His father's died and been buried, and his brothers are lying at his feet, pleading for mercy. And the words that Joseph speaks are his philosophy. Let's call it that rather than theology. His philosophy on life. And it's nothing less than a complete trust in the sovereignty of God. Verse 20, as we've read, he says, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. Can you hear? I mean, it's just a few words, isn't it? But embedded in those words, he is saying, in every circumstance of life, God is in control. You know, even when in our eyes, to our understanding, to our hopes and dreams and expectations, things aren't rosy, things aren't tickety-boo or hunky-dory. Nevertheless, Joseph is saying, God is using this situation for my good. God has allowed it for my benefit, perhaps even decreed it for my benefit. God is training me. God is disciplining me. God is teaching me something about him or about life. God is bringing about his purposes in my life, even in this situation. You know, the secret of life is here. The secret of happiness is here. To trust in an all-knowing, all-seeing, all-wise God in every situation can only bring contentment, peace, and joy. The things that people crave, things that we crave. So for Joseph, I don't know quite when he had his forehead smacking moment of the sovereignty of God, but he certainly expresses it in this verse here. And from these verses, I think we've got quite a lot to learn about living by faith. Just think about your life for a moment, or the end of it, perhaps. How do you want to be remembered? When someone stands at a funeral, maybe in this building, if it's this year, maybe, and I don't want to worry any of you, but maybe when we've extended a bit, it might be next year or the year after that, who knows. When somebody stands to give the tribute to your life, how do you want to be remembered? For me, as you know, the battle is on. Will I be remembered as a happy-go-lucky sort of chap, or that grumpy old geezer who stood up here from time to time and preached a sermon? What do you reckon? No, don't say. One thing I will be remembered for, I'm tall. How about that for a eulogy? He was tall. There's a story, you probably heard it, of a Yorkshireman whose wife died. And he wanted on the tombstone these words: "She was thine." But when the tombstone came, the engravers had made a bit of a mistake. And they'd written, she were thine. They'd written, "She were thin." And he wrote back to them and said, "You've missed an E off." So they took the stone, sent it back, and now it said, "E, she were thin." I put it to you, how you live now by faith is how you'll be remembered. You know, how you live now in relation with God is what will colour your eulogy when someone stands to give it at your funeral. Now, in these few verses here, we see a contrast between Joseph on the one hand and the brothers on the other hand. According to chapter 47 and verse 28, a couple of chapters previous to this, the family had now been in Egypt for 17 years. That's Joseph, his father Jacob, and his brothers for 17 years. And everything, I guess, was okay. But now Jacob dies, and suddenly all the old fears and the guilt and the doubts return to haunt the brothers. So when they saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" 17 years later. See, the brothers are not living by faith, but they're living by fear. They're still struggling with feelings of guilt from all those years ago when they sold their brother Joseph and pretended that he was dead. And their feelings about themselves produce judgments about Joseph. Suddenly, they're thinking he's like they are, and they're thinking he might bear a grudge against us. He might want revenge now for what we did to him. And these feelings within and these assumptions they make about Joseph lead to what is probably a dishonest attempt here to persuade Joseph to treat them kindly. This letter suddenly appears out of nowhere that Jacob is supposed to have written. This is what you're to say to Joseph: "I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." And even the words of this letter, just show how mixed up they are. There's an abject confession of their sins, but also a plea for Joseph to see them as servants of the God of your father. Here's a belt and braces approach to living by fear and not by faith. You see, these brothers are just a picture of how sinfulness in our lives can lead to guilt, and if it's unforgiven, can really mess up your life. Lynn will know about this, being a counsellor in the building next door. The brothers are just a picture of how a lack of faith in the sovereignty of God, how a lack of understanding in how the sovereignty of God works, can leave you floundering in your life. There's no foundation to build on. There's just a fear about what might happen in the future rather than a certainty that God's at work in your life. And just to say here, if there's anyone here this morning who's struggling with the burden, perhaps, of a sin that they've committed at some point in their past, or you've got no sense of forgiveness, either from God or from those that you've sinned against, you know, you need to get it sorted. Don't let it fester. Don't let it grow like a cancer in your life. Get it sorted. Bring it before God. Talk to someone. Go to counselling. Pray about it. Have someone pray with you. See, one option is to live in fear, and that would be then like these brothers. Or you could be like Joseph. What a contrast. And you could live by faith. When their message came to him, Joseph wept. There's possibilities, aren't there? Different possibilities for why he did this. Perhaps he was saddened by their lack of faith and their implication of Jacob in their sort of duplicity here with this letter. Perhaps he was saddened by the fact that despite 17 years of showing kindness to them, you know, somehow he'd failed to reassure them that he loved them and had forgiven them. Whatever, his brothers now throw themselves at his feet. "We are your slaves," they said. And by the way, doesn't this fulfill Joseph's dreams of all those years ago as the stars and the moon and the sun bowed down to him, as the sheaves of wheat bowed down to him? Anyway you look at this, it's not a great family scene. But Joseph's response, I think, can teach us some lessons about living by faith. First one is don't bear grudges. Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" You see, Joseph is refusing to play God. Joseph is saying, vengeance is not my job, it's God's. Even the judgment that might lead to vengeance is not my job, it's God's. And you see, if you're Joseph, and if getting even, if vengeance isn't your prime motive, then what is? You know what characterizes him? Then it's forgiveness, isn't it? I remember at the age of about 15, actually, I was thinking about this. I might have been a bit older. Must have been a bit older. I'd say about, I might even have been married, you know. So, what's that? 20-odd? 20-something? I don't know. Anyway, I was praying. No, I wasn't. I was playing centre-half for Halsall Reserves in the Southport and District League. It was a cup game. And the opponents had this one player who was a real sort of hard nut and put himself about quite hard tackles and fouls and things like that in midfield. And he got away with a tackle on my fellow centre-half and left him needing stitches. He had to be carried off and needed stitches. And the referee never saw it. Can you believe that? Well, I was seething. So I waited for my opportunity. Right? And I had the ball, and there was a chance, and I floored him. I went right through, took him, took the ball, took everything. The referee saw that and sent me off. So now we're without two centre-halves, and we lost. It was stupid, wasn't it, to take vengeance upon myself. And the Old Testament agrees with me when I say I'm stupid. Deuteronomy 32, verse 35, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And the New Testament agrees. Romans 12, 19, "Do not let the referee..." "Do not repay evil with evil. Do not take revenge, but leave room for God's wrath." See, we've already seen, haven't we, that a sense of being unforgiven can wreck your life. But equally as dangerous is an unforgiving spirit. bearing a grudge for a perceived wrong done to you. You'll know all about the family members who don't speak to each other for years. You'll know all about how it is at work when one of your colleagues, you know, has it in for you, or you hate them because of this, that and the other, and you don't get on very well together. You know how it is when churches divide because people, you know, fight and argue. We've all seen it. We've all experienced it. Take a lesson from Joseph, who doesn't bear a grudge. Am I in the place of God? He says. So don't bear grudges. The second one, though, and this is the biggie, verse 20, is to trust in God, and particularly in the sovereignty of God. Now, we said last week, and it's worth saying every week of this series, isn't it, that the sovereignty of God, in a nutshell, is that God is in control of all things. Last week, Abram, God says, go, and I will bless you, and I'll give you this land. And Abram goes. And we saw that God is a good God, and he makes nice promises, and therefore there aren't too many difficult questions. But this week, when we look at the sovereignty of God and trusting him, into the equation come some evil brothers intent on making Joseph's life as miserable as possible. And Potiphar's wife, intent on making his life as miserable as possible. Bad things happened to this basically good, if a little arrogant, young lad. Yet here we are at the end of Joseph's up and down adventures, and he's able to say to his brothers, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. Now, we don't know, do we? We don't know whether when he was down the well, or whether he was in prison, whether he was still thinking and saying things like this. And here he is now, you know, bestride a throne as the Prime Minister of Egypt, and I guess you could say, well, it's easy to say it now, isn't it? It's easy to say, God's in control now, and I've got this, and I've got that, and I've got the other. Maybe that's true, but we can learn from Joseph. We can learn something about God. God is in control, and in his control, he even embraces and uses the worst that mankind can do to still bring about his plans and purposes. Joseph knows this, doesn't he? God intended it for good. He allowed Joseph's brothers to do this to him because God sees the big picture. God knows the future, indeed, not just the future, he knows eternity. And he has a plan and a purpose for each and for all, which will be achieved. So here, in this story, lives are being saved from starvation because of this famine. And you know the big picture? From this period in Egypt, the people of God grew and grew to the point where they left Egypt in the Exodus and entered into the promised land after some time of ups and downs and depending on God and rejecting God, but learning lessons about God all the way through. In the promised land, through the judges, through the kings, again, learning about God and dependence on him and rejecting him, but learning lessons all the way through. Into exile, another lesson being learned. Back to Jerusalem, more lessons being learned. Jesus comes, Jesus lives and dies on a cross. All part of this plan and purpose of God. Out of that comes the church. Out of the church, a few thousand years later, comes Saltisford, in which this morning you are sitting. And God has got a plan and purpose for your life out of the fact that Joseph said, we're here today because of God's plans and purposes. Am I stretching that a bit far? I don't think so. Because God knows the future. It's amazing. God is sovereign. So we can learn something about him. But secondly, we can learn something about ourselves and our lives. Joseph may or may not have been quite so theologically aware whilst he was in the well or in the prison. But because of the story, his story, we can be. Those bad things that happened to us in the past. These difficult circumstances you find yourself in today, perhaps. That awkward time that might come into your life tomorrow. God's there. God's in it. God's using it. God's using it to sharpen you. God's using it to knock off your rough edges. God's using it to train and discipline you. God's in it to help you to trust in Him. God's in it to help you grow and to bring about His plans and purposes in your life and through you in the lives of others. God's in it to bring glory to His name. And often, the worse your situation is, the more glory goes to His name if you trust in Him. Just, you know, in recent months, some people have given testimony in this church. Just two that come to mind were Paul, who struggled for a job for a while. And I know it's a challenge now, Paul, isn't it? But you stood here and said, or you stood over there somewhere and said, that God had a great timing, a great sense of humour as well, because now you had a job just when the money was about to run out. See, God's in control. Michelle, is she here this morning? No. But, you know, most of us know Michelle's past, but how God has dealt and healed her in the present. Lots to give thanks for. God is in control. So you got tough times? Need to trust God. As someone has said, my life is but a weaving between my Lord and me. I cannot choose the colours He worketh steadily. Oft times He weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget He sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly shall God unroll the canvas and explain the reason why the dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern He has planned. I said this before, but I'll say it again. The Bible, I believe, can be summed up in three little words. There's two lots, actually, three little words here. First thing is, God is sovereign. But the second two, and these are the big three words, is trust in God. Simple, isn't it? And yet it's the most profound thing we'll ever do. Don't bear grudges. This life of faith, don't bear grudges. Trust in God. And thirdly, and just briefly, love your enemies. Verse 21. So then, he says, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. See, Joseph could have punished his brothers. But we've already seen he didn't do that. He could have forgiven them, but let them serve as slaves. I mean, that's reasonable, isn't it? They didn't deserve any more than that. But in fact, he went much further. He provides for them. He reassures them. He speaks kindly to them. And in verse 22, you read that he stayed with them then for the rest of his life in Egypt. And apparently, the Hebrew meaning behind this sentence here, the I, is emphatic. It's intensely personal. Don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. See, he's prefiguring Jesus, who said in Luke 6:27, love your family and friends? No. Love your neighbour? Yes. But love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. And this is what Joseph does. See, Joseph, when you look at his life, has this generosity of spirit. He's got a real heart of forgiveness despite what's been done to him. He has a deep sense of this trust in God, and you can sense the peace and the contentment and the joy coming out of his life. And this is all worked out in a reality of kindness and of generosity. This is what it is to live by faith, at least some aspects of it seen in Joseph's life. Don't bear grudges. Trust in God and love your enemies. And that leads to a life well lived now and a life that will be well remembered when you've gone. And even in dying, Joseph oozed this trust in the sovereign God who had plans for the people of God. Verse 24, Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. God had made these promises in the past to three generations of his forefathers. And it would be a generation or two more before they left Egypt. But for Joseph, it was all in the present because he trusted God and the promises that he made. Simple ingredients for a life of faith, so that at your funeral, someone might say, they were thine. We're going to sing a song together.